ちょうどいい感じで Ramanujacharya He was the founder who created a great revival in that eternal line of transcendental knowledge called the Sri Sampradaya. Have any of you been to Tirupati? Yes? That entire Tirupati temple is The worship is being run by the followers of Ramanujacharya. And also the largest temple in all of the world is a place called Sri Rangam. Have any of you been there? To Ranganath in India? It's near to the Tiruchirappalli in Tamil Nadu. That is also the followers of Ramanujacharya. Also the temple in Kanchipuram. Even to this day, there are tens of millions of devout worshippers of the Supreme Lord who follow his teachings. He had many disciples. One of them, his name was Quraysh. He was very learned. Very devoted. But you see, to understand spiritual knowledge takes more than just intelligence. It takes receiving the grace of God. Because there are two types of knowledge. There is theoretical and there is realized. Krishna says in Gita, Jnana in Vijnana. Jnana vijnana tirthatma. Theoretical knowledge is necessary so that we have some direction of what to do in our life by which we can receive the grace of God. But until that grace comes into our life, We cannot realize that knowledge. A crude example is if one is studying to be a surgeon and he gets best grades or she gets best grades in the university but never had any practical experience. On the basis of those grades, would you allow that person to perform heart surgery for you? Besides the grades, we want to know that this person really has experience. One has realizations of what that theoretical knowledge is all about. In spiritual life, in order to understand the truth of any shloka, we must receive the mercy of God, which comes through the mercy of Guru. Otherwise, we can memorize all scriptures and all slokas, but understand nothing. And most pundits, this is their situation. They understand everything, but they know nothing. Except they know how learned they are. And that is their greatest stumbling block from understanding what they think they know. So Quraysh was a very sincere devotee of the Lord. And he requested his Gurudev, Sri Ramanujacharya, can you explain to me this very important verse of the Bhagavad Gita, which is considered by all to be the essence of the Gita? Sarva dharmam parityaja mam ekam sharanam vraja aham tvam sarva papebhyo mukshayishami. Does anyone know the translation? Abandon all varieties of religion and just surrender to me. I shall relieve you from all sinful reactions. Do not fear. So Quraysh asked, can you tell me the real essence of what this shloka means? And Sri Ramanujacharya said, yes, but in order for you to be fit to understand what I will tell you, first you must give up absolutely every other desire in your life and serve your Guru for one full year without deviation. And Quraysh said that 1 year is a long time. What if I die before that year comes to its conclusion? If I do not understand this verse before I die, then my life is wasted. So can you give me something that is more according to my needs? Ramanujacharya thought for a few minutes. He said, all right. And for 1 month, you must become a beggar. And you must go door to door to beg for whatever you eat, whatever you wear, and everything. Now, Quraysh was a learned scholar. So he did like this, and he served his guru in this mood. And then after the month expired, Ramanujacharya saw that he was fit. His heart was a suitable field to plant this seed of knowledge. You know, if you plant a seed in a field that is not fertile, what will happen to the seed? It will not grow. But if you plant the seed in a fertile field, it will grow very fast. So in order for the seed of knowledge, spiritual knowledge, to actually take root and grow, our heart has to be fertile. And Krishna explains what the qualities of a fertile heart are. Tadvidi pranipatina pariprasnena seva. One must be submissive. One must inquire very sincerely. And one must be willing to do seva, service. Submissiveness is a natural quality which comes when we are humble. Without that humility, we cannot make any real spiritual progress. So Ramanujacharya seeing that his disciple was truly humble, he explained to him, and his disciple Quraysh was able to understand. At the same time that this took place, another disciple, who actually happened to be a very, very famous learned scholar, before he met Ramanujacharya, he was a great speaker and exponent of the Vedic scriptures. He was actually a teacher, and people from all around would come to hear him. But when he met Ramanuja and saw his purity and his qualities, he didn't want to be a teacher anymore. He wanted to be a disciple. So this person's name was Dasarathi. Dasarathi asked Ramanuja, "Can you also explain to me the essence of that 66th shloka of the 18th chapter of Gita, and what it really means to surrender everything to Krishna?" Ramanujacharya told him that because you are related to me, I suggest that you go to a very great saintly devotee named Gosti Purna. He lives in a village nearby, and you learn from him. He will explain the essence of this verse. So he went to Gosti Purna and told him that my Gurudev has given me this instruction, that I should come to you and I should inquire, what is the essence of this verse, which is the essence of all scriptures? The highest knowledge. He said, "I will explain it to you, but you stay here and you just do humble service for some time." So for one full year, he stayed and he served with great humility Gosti Purna. And at the end of the year, he inquired, "Can you explain this verse to me?" He said, "Actually, Ramanujacharya is much more qualified to explain this than me, so you should go back to him." So he went back to Ramanujacharya and fell at his lotus feet. And he said, "I served Gosti Purna for one full year, and then he told me that you will explain it." Just at that time, Ramanujacharya, one of his instructing gurus named Mahapurna, his daughter came in great distress. And she fell at Ramanuja's feet and she said, "My father has told me to come to you because I'm in a very, very distressed condition." Ramanuja said, "What is your problem?" She said that, "I'm married to one person in a particular village, and the mother and father, my husband, are very cruel to me. They're putting me in so much distress. Every day I have to walk 2 miles to go to a well to get water. And then I have to carry all that water on my own head and shoulders and back and everything all the way 2 miles back. And I become terribly exhausted. And then when I return to the home, because I can't be there in time, they want me to go so fast. My mother-in-law, she chastises me very severely. And when I tell her that I'm becoming very sick and I'm completely exhausted, they won't even feed me until I do this work. And then I have to do all the cooking. When I tell her that I'm sick and I'm exhausted, she chastises me. What do you want? You want, why don't you bring a Brahmin cook with you from your father's house? You expect us to hire someone? You are simply lazy." In this way, she said, I couldn't bear living in that house anymore. So I returned to my father's house, and he told me I should discuss this matter with you. And when Ramanuja saw that she was so sincere and so honest, but she was really being harassed and persecuted. Sometimes this happens in Indian family life, you know. So Ramanuja said, well, I have the solution. You see this devotee, Dasarathi? He will go home with you, and from now on he will carry the water, and he will do all the cooking. So here was this very great scholar and philosopher. He bowed out at his guru's feet. He said, whatever you say, Gurudev, I will do. So he went back to this village, and every day he was carrying water 2 miles, going 2 miles, bringing it back 2 miles. He would do the cooking, and if anyone was to be chastised, it was him. Nobody knew who he was. They just thought he was just some menial laborer doing the cooking. So he performed this service for 6 full months. Without complaining, very quietly just going about his business as the most menial servant. One day, when he was walking through the village, one pundit was reading from the scriptures. And this very menial cook, servant, and water boy happened to hear him speaking, and he was discussing the wrong explanation of a certain sloka. So Dasarathi, he spoke up in this public assembly, so many people around. He said, I know that you're a great learned scholar, but what you are saying is not correct. And then he explained very briefly the proper understanding of a particular sloka. The scholar, he was so furious. He began to chastise Dasarathi. And who are you? I am a great learned pundit, and you are just someone who carries water and just cooks for an ordinary family? Who are you to question my scholarship and my understanding of the Vedas? He said, you should go home and just continue your cooking. Do what you're supposed to do. Dasarathi, very humbly, as if he didn't hear anything, he continued to explain the proper understanding of this particular sloka, and he explained the principles of Sanatan Dharma so clearly and so purely that the pundit himself came off his raised platform and bowed at the feet of the cook. And everyone in the village was wondering, who are you? We have never, in all our lives, heard such explanations of the Vedas. And then they found out he was the great famous preacher, Dasarathi. They said, well, what are you doing here? You should be preaching to hundreds and thousands of people. What are you doing in our village, carrying water and cooking for this crazy family? He said, my guru, Ramanujacharya, has given me this instruction, that this is what I am meant to do. So the leaders of this village, they went to Srirangam, and they went to Ramanuja and said, please, your disciple, Dasarathi, he is so humble, he is so gentle, he is so learned. Why? This is not fair for him to be just washing pots and carrying water. But he will not question you, and he will not leave his service until you give him permission. So Ramanuja was so happy, so pleased to hear of his disciples' genuine humility and willingness to serve his guru in any condition, that Ramanuja personally went with the people back to that village. And there, when he found Dasarathi, he embraced him. He said, now you come back. And as they were walking back to Srirangam, he explains the essence of this verse of Bhagavad Gita. So we learn from this wonderful story of Shripad Ramanujacharya what really is the qualification to understand God. We have to use our good intelligence to philosophically discriminate between what is reality and what is truth and what is illusion. We must apply whatever capacity God has given us to search out the highest truth. But in order to realize it, we have to be very humble. We have to be in the mood of a very menial servant. In the Bhagavad Gita, we find Arjuna. He was also speaking so many learned words. But until he humbled himself before Krishna and said, actually, I'm suffering and I cannot figure out the way out of this suffering. You please instruct me. Then Krishna spoke. This is the science of self-realization. Real knowledge is a gift that comes by the grace of God when we are so anxious to receive it and our heart is humble and willing to serve. Spiritual realization and pride are contradictory. Of course, we find oftentimes as people make spiritual advancement, they become proud of their spiritual advancement. But actually, at the point that that pride starts coming in, all spiritual advancement stops. And it is only an illusion of spiritual advancement that we are proud of. Therefore, we find that the really great personalities, they are always anxious to learn. They are always anxious to serve. They are always anxious to put themselves last and be the servant of the servants. We are not these material bodies, and we are not these minds. These are external temporary coverings for the eternal soul. The soul is part of God, is pure, is full of knowledge, and is full of bliss. False ego, the intelligence, the mind, and this body with all of its various constituencies, they are all an illusory identity. How to realize that we are that eternal pure soul that is part of God, that is beyond birth and beyond death. The soul is not limited to a particular caste or a particular sex or a particular material condition of any sort. For this realization, we must go beyond the intelligence, the mind, and the ego. We must actually surrender to God. And what does it mean to surrender? That you know Krishna and I do not. That your will be done in my life. That is surrender. And anyone can do it if they are sincere and if they have that desire. And spiritual life means to cultivate that sincere desire. And how is that done? By associating with people who are striving to develop that sincere desire. In that association, we learn how to regulate our lives in such a way that we have a spiritual basis to all that we do. All of you are students studying medicine. There is a lot of competition. There are a lot of deadlines. A lot of anxieties, exams, projects, working for some diploma. It's a fierce endeavor by which you cannot be lazy. And when you get out of your college, don't think that the world is any easier. Whatever profession you go into, or even if you just go into family life, there will be so many pressures, so many anxieties, so much competition, so many disappointments. It is the nature of the world. And no one can change the nature of this world. Yesterday, one lady was telling me that she was talking to someone else, and that person was another lady. I don't know what ladies talk about when they've come together, but she was telling me one discussion. She said, this lady, she already had some abortions and she wanted some operation to make it so no children could come, so she won't have any more abortions. And I was just thinking, just see the nature of this world. You can't get away from suffering. If you have sex and have a child, that taking care of that child entails so much suffering. Right? You need so much money to provide for it, so much time, so much energy. And if you don't want to have a child, then you have to control your sex impulse and not have sex, which is also a tremendous amount of suffering, just to tolerate this urge. Huh? And if you have a child, and then you don't want it, and you have an abortion, then you have to suffer the karma consequence. According to the Manu Samhita, anyone who's in any way involved in abortion has to be born in a womb and aborted without seeing the light of the day for 100 births. So that's a terrible amount of suffering. And if you have this operation, because you're defying the natural arrangement that God has made, and you're shutting off the natural facility that God has given you, there will also be a karmic reaction in which there will be so much suffering. So, what to do? You cannot get away from the suffering. If you become a brahmachari, you have to suffer tolerating the sex impulse. Or if you're grihastha and you don't, you have to, it's a suffering. And if you have a child, there's suffering. And if you try to stop the child artificially, there's terrible suffering. So I was thinking, in this world, you cannot escape suffering. No matter what you do, you will suffer. But an intelligent person will accept that type of suffering by which he can be freed from suffering in the future. And an ignorant person will engage in those activities by which he'll try to relieve the suffering now, but suffer terribly in the future. Krishna says in Gita that one tastes like nectar in the beginning, tastes like poison in the end. And what tastes like poison at the beginning tastes like nectar at the end. What tastes like poison at the beginning? Controlling our senses and our mind. It's very difficult. But it's like nectar in the end. Because as you begin to conquer your mind and senses, you're liberated, you're free, and you can perceive God in everything and everywhere. By our loving service toward Him. And what tastes like nectar in the beginning, just enjoying and trying to escape the reaction of our enjoyment, it tastes like poison at the end. This is intelligence. To understand what is ultimately good for us and what will carry us to a higher destination. But in any case, this is a world of struggle. It is a world of disappointment, and you cannot change the world, but you can change yourself. And how do we do that? By immunizing ourselves from the disease of material distress. You are all doctors. Sometimes you know that if you're going into a disease-ridden place to try to help people, or even if you're just living there for any reason, you should get, what do you call it, immunization? What is immunization? You can explain. You shall. It means protecting yourself from disease. But there's some austerity in immunization. Someone has to give you some injection, and it hurts. Nobody likes injections. At least I never knew any crazy people like that. But you have to accept some pain for the immunization. But if you take that immunization regularly, you are protected from the disease. And you can do your work, and you can even help those who have the disease. So the disease of material life is suffering. And what is the immunization? To associate with devotees. To rise in the morning and chant God's holy name. Every day we should immunize ourselves from material contamination by chanting the Lord's name. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare.
And we should regularly associate with devotees who actually give us a proper understanding and direction in life. And our social relationships should be with these types of people. See, in this world, people are under the illusion of having fun. Life is meant to enjoy, but it is meant to give enjoyment to the soul, not just to this mind and senses, which are so fickle and ever changing. You see, when devotees come together, they actually enjoy. They have wonderful fun. They chant, they dance, they discuss wonderful subject matters, they take prasad, so many nice things. And they love each other, and they develop loving relations with each other. It's the most enjoyable life. But the whole purpose of these social exchanges is that we progress toward the real goal of life. And we help to protect ourselves from wasting our lives and from implicating ourselves in further suffering. We help to protect ourselves from the disease of material illusion. So if we're serious about attaining higher goal in life, then our social relationships should be centered around this principle. Not simply around having fun. Not simply around liking each other. Because today you may like each other, but tomorrow you may hate each other. That's the nature of friendship in this world. We should we have to do our duties, and that's subjecting us to so much anxiety and so much suffering and so much competition and so much demands. So when we have time to free ourselves from these duties, we should be working always on improving our life, on purifying our life, on elevating our consciousness. And this means choosing those people that we make our most intimate friendships with those who share the same purpose of life with us. And there's actually a value to our friendship. Not just a flickering sense of pleasure, but there's a meaning. There's actually progress being made amongst each other. This is so important. And also in our own lives, we must regularly stabilize our consciousness, immunize it from the disease of illusion of this world. By reading those sacred books which enlighten us, like Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and by chanting God's name. Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
And by avoiding those activities which further incriminate us in bondage and contamination, like illicit sex, intoxication, gambling, meat eating. These things incriminate us in bondage and great suffering. So we should forego these things. We should live a pure life. We should live a stable life. And we should proceed in this way in a spirit of humility and service, as Ramanujacharya has taught us. And then we can be in this world but not of this world. We can perform our duties, whether they be household duties or whether they be academic duties or whatever. And we can be like a lotus flower. Even if we're in the muddiest, dirtiest places, our consciousness can remain always with Krishna. So you cannot change the world, but you do have the power to change your own life, your own perception of the world. And it takes time. It is not something so cheap. It may take years, it may take your entire life. But if you are sincere and you honestly endeavor, the gratification internally that you're making progress, that you're doing the right thing, will give you great strength. And in the end, with the grace of the Supreme Lord Krishna, you will certainly achieve the most priceless wealth, the greatest treasure. And what is that greatest treasure? When that eternal love of the heart is awakened. When we are liberated from all dualities of material conception, and we are always immersed in the loving service of the Lord. Because that is the one duty that is eternal. And we should not forsake that eternal duty for any of the temporary obligations we have in this world. Never. We should never neglect that one eternal sacred duty of the soul. But we must orient all our other activities in this world in pursuance of that one supreme duty, the loving service of the Supreme Lord. You are also fortunate. You have Devamrita Prabhu to guide you. He's much better than me at describing all these things. And now, Kishori has come to Sion Medical School for Krishna because he has seen how sincere many of you young girls are. He has sent a very wonderful devotee to be your friend and to live amongst you. Dhananjaya Vishant. Very serious devotees of the Lord. Actually, you are all very serious. And he has given you each other, that is his great mercy. And take advantage of that wonderful opportunity. There are so many sincere seekers of the truth, so close. And in this way, you can find what is real happiness, real purpose. If there's any questions, I can try to ask. Human life is meant for tapasya. The nature of our material conditioning is we like to do so many things that are not good for us. But if we want to progress in life, we have to be willing to tolerate those things and replace those negative desires and activities with positive spiritual desires. For instance, it is the nature of a conditioned soul to like to sleep. Everyone agrees? Devamrit doesn't agree. He hates to sleep. But the rest of us like to sleep. In fact, it's Devamrit that wakes everyone up every morning. But you see, if you come to Radha Gopinath temple, although everyone likes to sleep, they rise around 4 o'clock, 4:15 in the morning, and by 5 o'clock, everyone has already taken bath, and they're dancing jubilantly in front of the beautiful deities of Radha. They're singing and they're dancing. Now during the kirtan, when they're singing and dancing, they are not thinking so much about sleeping. They're simply having a wonderful time with Krishna. Now, if they didn't get up to have nice dancing and chanting for Mangal Arati, and they just sat in their bed, what would they do? They would go back to sleep. Correct? So what you have to do is you have to tolerate the urge for these lower activities. But at the same time, you have to replace it with something positive. Something positive that is spiritual and elevating to your consciousness. And then it is possible to give up these lower desires. Unless you replace it with something higher, it becomes very difficult. But if you're willing to make that substitution, by positive engagement, it becomes not only possible, but it becomes wonderful. This is tapasya. You have to be willing to accept the initial pain of giving up the things that you are conditioned to like. But you have to replace it simultaneously with something better. Then you become purified, and you can remain regulated, and you can progress. The idle mind is the devil's workshop. If you're idle, you will want to go to sleep. But if you're busy doing something that's meaningful, then you don't have to go to sleep. Just like many of you, you go on vacations to go home. Usually when you go home, how do you spend most of your time? Sleeping, right? Because there's really not much to do at home. Sleep. But when you're busy and you have something more important to do, then you do it. So you have to understand what is the importance of your spiritual progress. Krishna says in Gita, one should not sleep too much or sleep too little. If you sleep too little, you cannot concentrate your mind on anything. And if you sleep too much, you are simply wasting your life. So we should understand that we just take what we need so that we can perform our service with the optimum effect. Generally, for the normal human being, 6 hours is all that is required. And usually we want more than 6 hours because we like to sleep. But as far as the maximum efficiency of the human body, 6 hours gives you the proper energy. More than that generally makes you fall deeper under the influences of ignorance. And then you have to be very busy for Krishna, chanting his names, dancing for him, serving him. It's like some of our devotees here in Sion Hospital, they have Mangal Arati every day. Yes? Boys and girls both, men and women both, Mangal Arati. So this is a wonderful way to regulate your life, not waste it unnecessarily. Rise early and make the first offering of your consciousness to Krishna. Every day when you wake up, make the first offering of your life to Krishna every day. Come for the Mangal Arati. Chant together. Hear the truth together amongst each other. Give as much of your life as possible. Yes, that is the mind. We have so many desires. Let me first fulfill these desires so I'm not so agitated and disturbed, and then I will do devotional service. This is what you're saying. This is like saying, let me put the fire out by putting gasoline in it, and then I'll be nice and cool. The more petrol that you put in the fire, the hotter and more severe it becomes. So when we try to put out the fire of lusty desires through material enjoyment, we're actually making the fire burn hotter. Sense gratification is fuel for our kama or for our material desires. And you can never put out a fire by putting on fuel. It makes it bigger. At the beginning, it appears to go down. It's like if you have a fire and you throw a big log in it. When you throw the log in, the fire goes down. And it thinks, oh, now the fire is less. But as soon as that log begins to become consumed, that log of wood, the fire is bigger than ever. You take a fire and you throw a big quantity of petrol on it. When the petrol first hits it, the fire goes down. But then within seconds, it's bigger than ever. There's absolutely no difference. If you want the fire to go down, two things you must do. One is stop putting petrol in it. And two is start putting water on it. Devotional activities are like water. But if you're putting water and petrol, both, then what happens? It goes like this. Fire goes crazy, doesn't know what to do. Right? So if you're practicing spiritual life, but at the same time you're still engaging in materialistic sinful activities, then you're doing like that. Better to just stop the petrol and put nice, clear water. Well, you're a doctor. I'll use another example. If your patient comes to you with a terrible itching rash, do you tell him, scratch it? Scratch it to your heart's content. Will you tell him that? Huh? You're a doctor? Person comes, terrible. He comes in like, it's itching so bad, doctor. Please do something. Do you tell him, well, if it itches, you should just scratch it. What happens when you scratch a rash? It itches more. But while you're scratching it, it feels very nice. Correct? You've seen people. They're like, it actually feels nice while you're scratching. It feels wonderful. It feels ecstatic while you're scratching. But as soon as you stop, what? It becomes worse. You're just aggravating it. So the doctor will say, yes, I know it feels good when you scratch it, but don't scratch it, because you're just torturing yourself. Instead of scratching it, you take this tablet and you put this salve, some cream, upon it. But as you put the cream on it and as you're taking the salve, still you want to scratch it. You have to go like this. I won't. I'll put the right thing on it, and no matter how much I want, I will not scratch it. Prahlad Maharaj has explained that sense gratification is like scratching an itch. It only makes it worse. It doesn't make it better. Immediately it feels better. It tastes like nectar at the beginning, but poison at the end. You have to stop scratching and give it the right medicine. And what is the right medicine?
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare.
And other devotional activities. That answers your question? Is there any other questions?
Around us, everybody is so much competitive, everybody is trying to work so hard to become more famous, to get more prestige, to get more good marks and to study further and further. When we hear about spiritual life, we like it, but don't want to take it so seriously. When we hear that life is full of misery, and that when we enter the medical field around 18 years, nobody has actually suffered anything positively. We hear about others suffering, but because actually we have not suffered, we don't realize the body is actually suffering. And everybody around is just trying to earn more and more and trying to work harder and harder. And when we hear about spiritual life at that stage, we like it, but we don't want to take it seriously. But we know that actually that is the true goal of life. So how can we become sincere and avoid not listening to others and try to take spiritual life seriously?
Medical profession is glamorous, you said? It's glamorous? I never heard of such a crazy thing. Glamorous. I guess if you say, people think it's glamorous?
Yes, something like that.
Something like that. Is treating people's diseases as glamorous? The medical field today is very, very corrupt and perverted. In the past, no one was a doctor for money or glamour. In the past, the only people that wanted to be doctors were the people who really wanted to help others. They didn't care for their own profit, adoration, or distinction. They wanted to help people who were suffering. That was the motivation for anyone to take to the medical field. It was generally the Brahmins. And they would never accept any pay for the services that they would offer. That is the origin of the medical field, both in the East and the West. In India, there was surgery in all things, medicines, and it was Brahmins. They never charged fees. They would simply do it out of compassion because they wanted to help people, because they hated to see people suffering. And they themselves would live very simple lives. They didn't care for anything. They just wanted to help them. It was a sacrifice. There was no consideration of prestige or profits. It was only a seva, a service. This is how the medical field went on for thousands and thousands of years here in India. And it worked a lot better than what people are doing today. And in the West, the Greeks, the Romans, what is that one oath that most doctors take? Hippocrates. What is the oath? Anybody know it?
I do not do that. But you are getting.
Huh?
Please, I do not waste your money. I do not do anything.
I take care of the soul right from the conception till the.
The Hippocrates oath is completely free of any tinge of profit, adoration, or distinction. The spirit of that oath is that you're actually sacrificing your life for the welfare of humanity. Is it not? This was what every doctor would do. But in this day and age, our society is so polluted, so perverted, and so corrupt that people take to medicine without the slightest concern of compassion for others. They just do it with a concern for selfish profit and distinction, glamour. Just like in the Western world, in America, there's all sorts of soap operas centered around life in hospitals. I don't know if you've heard about it. Remember when we were children? Yeah, crazy things.
It's
still happening. All these serial and television shows of all the romances and all of the intrigues that take place behind the doors of the operating room. And it's like something glamorous. It's all nonsense. You should not be in the medical field for these things. It's simply Maya. It's simply illusion. You should be in the medical field because it is a wonderful way that you can help the suffering of humanity, and it's a wonderful way to serve God. It's so immoral to take a profession in the name of helping people to serve your own greed. Simple living, I think. Through your spiritual progress, you should be content with a simple life, and you should use your skills to help others. But yes, most of the students today, they are simply greedy. They want glamour. They want selfish pleasures for themselves through whatever they do. And they want to facilitate it through their education. And if you want to be like them, then you will spoil your human life. They'll never be satisfied. The material world won't let you be satisfied. One of our devotees was just telling me, the most famous heart surgeon in the entire world is an American. He made so many millions and millions of dollars. What he charges for one operation, you probably won't make your whole life. And he does about 8 operations a day. Anyways, he invested all his tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, and he lost it all in one day. He lost everything in one day. And because of that, it was such a blow to his life that now his hands shake, so he can't even do another operation. So he can't even make any more money. So he has nothing but debts, and he has no way to make money anymore. And he's an old man. He's in his, I think, what is his name? It's Dr. Cooley or something? Huh? You heard this story? It's a true story. This is the reality behind the so-called glamour. He's almost 70 years old. Something like that, 60s, in the 60s. The greatest profession any doctor has ever had in the modern century. And what does he have to show for it? Frustration, broken heart, and poverty. It's not that we like to see these things happen, but it's the reality that we can't escape. If you are greedy, you will suffer to the extent you are greedy. That is the law of nature in due course of time. If you are compassionate, charitable, self-satisfied with inner realizations, then to that degree you never have to see these things. So don't associate so closely with such people who have a perverted motive for their education. You should feel sorry for them. They're misusing their life. They're misusing a sacred occupation which is meant for the deliverance of suffering. And they're using it to perpetuate suffering through greed. Associate with people who have the intention to be kind, to be generous, and to be pure in their life. And then you will get the real gift. And if you take to spiritual life, then all those types of people will think you're crazy. And they will even make fun of you, criticize you. No doubt. But we don't mind. Better to live for the truth than to just surrender to the folly of illusion. If we are not grateful for something, that thing gets taken away. If your parents give you something and you're not grateful for that thing, then they will take it. You will lose it. We have to understand what you are saying. That devotees are so kind. They're giving us the most wonderful thing. Of their own association, their guidance, direction. And we should show our gratitude by trying to assist them in every way we can. And the first way to assist them is to simply accept what they're giving us with a grateful heart. Just like, for instance, Devamrita Prabhu is coming regularly. And if you want to show your gratitude for him coming, then every time he comes, you'll be there. If nobody comes, he makes all the trouble to come all this way, and he's so busy. He gives up his sleep, he gives up everything just to come here. If nobody comes, or if nobody's very interested, or if nobody's willing to help him, then he simply, Krishna will take him away. He will not come anymore. But if you're anxious to hear, and you're present when he speaks, and you're anxious to assist him in any way possible, then the more you want from him, the more he'll want to give to you. Huh? And the more he wants to give to you, the more you want, the more Krishna will give you the desire to want. The more we try to hear from the devotees, receive what they're given, and help them to give it to others, the more we do that, the more Krishna will give us the desire. And that's how we show our gratitude. We should feel that we have nothing. If someone comes to give us something precious, we should be so grateful. We should take it. We should be willing to help them. A grateful heart can receive God. A grateful heart can receive the mercy of God. And what is the devotees giving you? The mercy of God. To the degree your heart is grateful and you're willing to reciprocate, to that degree, Krishna will give you more and more and more. So we should know that the devotees are really our best friends because they're giving us the most priceless of all treasures. They're giving us the means of eternal life and real love and real peace and real joy. Don't take it cheaply.
Spiritual organizations and groups. First of all, there are so many religions, and out of again Indian culture, there are so many groups. And again, in that group, there are subgroups and subgroups. So it is totally confused that even if you go Vaishnavism, there are four sampradayas. Even if you go to one sampradaya, then there will be so many groups. Now, even if you go to again later in the Prabhupada, then again there are groups. So he said that actually everybody is confused. So there is nothing reality. And my mother is so pious, she said, no, no, actually everybody is true. So, two days back, I was discussing with a senior, then she also told the same thing, and again I got confused. And I remembered all those discussions. So, I am confused.
come to confuse us. So your father's belief is that everyone's wrong, and your mother believes that everyone's right, and you're in the middle. That is because neither of them have any philosophy. They both have their sentiments and their emotions, but no philosophy. And that is why philosophy is required to understand the truth. It is said religion without philosophy is only sentimentalism or fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. From what it sounds to me, your father is philosophy without religion. He has a big brain that's analyzing everything, but because he has no devotional connection, he rejects it. And your mother, she's very religious, she has a sentiment of devotion, but because no philosophical understanding, just accepts everything and anything. Philosophy must be put into practice. Devotion means to put our philosophy into practice. We actually have to follow principles and we have to follow a particular spiritual guide. And our devotion has to be rooted on a philosophical understanding of the truth. Otherwise, there is so much conflict between everybody on the basis of different forms of belief. So if you have a proper philosophical understanding of what is the truth, and you have a path by which you can apply that philosophy to your life, then there will be no confusion. And that is what is important. There may be so many religions and there may be so many paths, but philosophically they're all saying real religion means to understand that you're not this body, that you are the eternal soul, and that you're part of God, and to live in harmony with God, who is the source of everything that exists. All we have to understand what is real religion. That which teaches these simple principles is real religion. That which teaches anything else is bogus. It is not real religion. And amongst the real religions of the world, there was no contradiction. There was no conflict. There are different levels of religious thought, which creates a variation. It's like there's high school, there's college, there's university, and there's postgraduate. You don't learn the same thing. You learn, it's the same subject, but are different degrees of understanding that subject. So various religious systems teach different levels of understanding of God and different realizations of God. If we don't understand the subject, we'll appear that they're conflict. We appear that they're contradicting each other, that they're teaching something different. It's not something different. It's just higher and lower grades of the same subject. If you understand the philosophy of religion, you'll be able to see this in truth. You'll see the harmony and the oneness of all religions if they are being presented properly. In Krishna consciousness, these teachings are based on the Gita, on the Srimad Bhagavatam, the standard spiritual textbooks. They are not based on anyone's concoctions or anyone's speculation. And they are being handed down by a line of great acharyas. We say there are four sampradayas, but in all four sampradayas we find the acharyas all accept the acharyas of all other sampradayas as their gurus. Today we were glorifying the life of Ramanujacharya. He is from a different sampradaya. We are from the Madhva sampradaya. We are actually from the Gaudiya sampradaya. Yesterday was the disappearance day of Madhvacharya. We were teaching, we were explaining his glories. Today we are explaining the glories of Ramanujacharya. Because he didn't teach anything different than what Lord Chaitanya taught. Lord Chaitanya simply taught the most simple and sublime process of practicing. What did Ramanujacharya teach?
To surrender to Krishna.
What did Madhvacharya teach? To surrender to Krishna. What did Nimbarkacharya teach? To surrender to Krishna. And Vishnu Swami taught to surrender to Krishna. And Vallabhacharya teaches to surrender to Krishna. And ultimately Shankaracharya taught to surrender to Krishna. And Jesus Christ taught to surrender to Krishna. Christ is an American word. The Greek word is Krishna. And if you study the grammatical, linguistic, derivation of Krishna. It comes from Karish, Karishta. Karish means to attract. Jesus taught to surrender to Krishna. He taught to surrender to Krishna. And Muhammad, one of the names of God in the Muslim faith is Rama. A thousand names of Allah, 100 names of Allah, one is Rama. Muhammad taught to surrender to Rama, or to Allah. They're all teaching to surrender to the same God. But they're giving different degrees of information of that same God. And according to the culture that they're being taught, they may be giving some different cultural expressions of surrendering to that same God. They're all teaching to surrender to the one God.